May it please the court. My name is Shannon Jeffrey, and I represent Mr. Dang in this case. Due to my time constraints, I'm going to focus on issue one, the Batson issue. But if you have any questions about the other issues, I will do my best to address those as well. Turning to Batson. At the end of opposing counsel's argument in the answer brief, she compares this case to People v. Marion, which was published in 1996. In Marion, a panel of this court concluded that there was nothing in the record to discredit the prosecutor's explanation for striking a black panelist. The prosecutor's reasons included that the panelist was, quote, not forthcoming or didn't volunteer much information, and the prosecutor was concerned about the panelist's demeanor and, quote, the way he answered questions. Now, the prosecutor in Marion stated other reasons that were not present in our case, but those that I just mentioned sound an awful lot like the court's ruling in this case, don't they? Here, as if the court had the Marion opinion in hand, it concluded that Sherelle Jackson was not, quote, forthcoming or engaging with attorneys. The term forthcoming was never used by the prosecutor in explaining her strike at Sherelle Jackson. So that descriptor came directly from the trial court, who was relying on the Marion case. But let's get back to Marion. In Marion, the defense argued that the prosecutor's justification for challenging the prospective juror was a pretext for racial discrimination. It depended on a subjective assessment of demeanor. This court disagreed, concluding that nothing in the record discredited the prosecutor's facially race-neutral explanations. But, Your Honors, the Batson analysis has evolved since then. It's no longer sufficient to simply take the prosecutor's facially race-neutral explanations at face value. Nearly 10 years after this court decided Marion, the United States Supreme Court decided Miller L. v. Drecke and emphasized the need for a comparative juror analysis at step three of the Batson analysis. In Miller L., published in 2005.
Counsel, can I just briefly interrupt you?
Sure.
So you're arguing step three, right?
I am.
Okay, thanks.
Morrell was published in 2005, and the Supreme Court concluded, quote, if a prosecutor's proffered reason for striking a black panelist applies just as well to an otherwise similar non-black who is permitted to serve, that is evidence tending to prove purposeful discrimination to be considered at Batson's third step, unquote. That sounds like a mandate to me, to be considered.
Is that in Miller L., was there were there any blacks on the panel that was ultimately selected who were not struck?
I would have to go back and read it, but my recollection is that 1 out of 10 remained on the panel, like 9 out of 10 were struck, something like that.
In this case, 1 out of 11. In this case, there's 1 out of 2 that was on the panel, right?
That's true. There were only 2 black panelists available on the panel. Yes.
And wasn't the trial court much better situated than this court is to assess the juror's demeanor and to make a record about its own conclusion about the juror's whether the juror was or was not forthcoming?
Well, Your Honor, in this case, I would disagree, because if you're talking about something like eye contact or maybe something that isn't reflected in the written record, that could be true. But here, the prosecutor said not very engaging. She was talking about the verbal responses from the panelist, Sherelle Jackson, that were recorded in the record. And when you compare those responses to the responses of the other jurors in this case, specifically the language used, it becomes evident that Ms. Jackson's responses did not stand out as not forthcoming, and that she was just as engaged as many of the white panelists who were allowed to remain on the jury.
How many other jurors were actually admonished to speak up and to sort of verbalize their responses? Because the record does reflect that she was either quiet or wasn't very engaged.
Quiet, I'm not sure about quiet. I would have to go back and look. But I believe what the prosecutor was talking about when she said not very engaging, because she followed right up with, she said yes to everything, or she agreed with everything I said. So when those two phrases are put together, not very engaging, agree with everything I said, to me that means that she thought that Sherelle Jackson was being too agreeable and perhaps not giving perhaps she wasn't giving her full honest answers, saying her full honest answers on the record. But there's nothing to back that up. There's nothing suggesting that she had another agenda and was giving answers that were designed to please the prosecution, even though they weren't truthful. The Marion court did not have the benefit of this mandate from Miller-El when it reached the third step of the Batson analysis. Had that court engaged in the comparative juror analysis, the result in Marion may have been different. But that doesn't really matter. What matters is that the defense here argued for the comparative juror analysis, but the trial court ultimately failed to engage in one. Defense counsel specifically argued based on, quote, the comparison to the other jurors who have not been excused, there's no race-neutral reason to exclude her. To address this argument, the trial court was obligated under Miller-El, under that mandate, to take a recess, to review the transcript of voir dire, and to perform a comparative juror analysis. But unfortunately, the trial court just didn't recognize that mandate.
Did the defense counsel ask the court to do that?
Defense counsel simply stated, compared to the other jurors. So that brought forth the comparative juror suggestion.
Wouldn't have been, I mean, isn't there some burden on defense counsel to say, compare this juror to juror X, Y, Z, and AA, pointing out some specifics rather than just saying compared to other jurors? I mean, it's up to the trial court to do all that analysis without the defense counsel having to bear any burden in that regard?
Well, I think the burden is satisfied by mentioning compared to other jurors. I mean, under Miller-El, it says to be considered. That's a mandate for the court. So I think even with no suggestion of the comparative juror analysis, there's still a mandate under Miller-El by the United States Supreme Court to perform that. Because what Miller-El says is, if you don't compare the struck minority black panelists' responses to everybody else, there's really no way for the trial court to assess the credibility of the facially race-neutral explanations in step two.
And after the trial court accepted the race-neutral reasons for her exclusion, didn't defense counsel merely say, well, I can't believe agreeing with her is, you know, a good reason to strike her? I mean, he didn't actually follow up with saying, hey, wait a minute, let's take a look at who remains and how they're similar or dissimilar from the structure.
Well, it's true that defense counsel said, because in step two, one of the proffered race-neutral explanations from the prosecutor was, well, she simply agreed with everything I said. And there was a rebuttal applied to that, which was, well, I can't believe if she agrees with everything you said that that's a facially race-neutral reason for excluding her. That did happen, and that was the rebuttal. But any lack of rebuttal does not waive any of the rights in step three. And that's, in my case, there's case law saying that. So no matter what rebuttal is given or lack thereof, that doesn't waive the procedure that the trial court must engage in at every step of the Batson analysis.
Did Miller change how courts are to review the third step? So I understand the third step, the court's decision is an issue of fact.
I'm sorry, what's the question? The standard of review?
Yeah, did it change the analysis that you use for the third step in Batson?
Did Miller-El. Miller-El expanded the analysis. I don't think it necessarily changed the standard of review.
It
had engaged in the comparative juror analysis. If they go through the proper legal procedure and do the comparative juror analysis, and then the court bases its findings of fact on that analysis, then it gets the deference. Then it gets the clear error standard. But if they never even go to the trouble of doing the comparative juror analysis, then they don't have all the information with which to make those factual findings that would be due deference. So that's the problem, is that there was a fatal flaw in the procedure of how this court engaged in step three of the Batson analysis, because it wasn't aware of Miller-El. It wasn't aware that it had to compare these responses to other people's in the jury. And if the court had done that, it would become very obvious that the facade of neutrality just evaporated in this case.
Counsel, let me just ask a couple of practical questions.
Okay.
In this case, was there a court reporter present, or was it by tape recording? Do you know?
I do not remember. I'm sorry.
But you said it was the obligation of the trial court to call a recess and go and review the transcript.
Yes.
So he needed to, or she, I forget, the trial court needed to adjourn and for perhaps a few days and get the transcript transcribed. Is that what you're suggesting? Or is he supposed to listen to the entire tape? I'm not exactly sure how this would happen, since you're saying that the defense counsel has no obligation to call the court's attention to anything in particular.
Your Honor, I'm going to reserve that question for rebuttal because I have trial counsel in the room with me, and I'm going to ask him if he recalls.
Okay.
I think I will save the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you very much. May it please the court. My name is Erin Grundy, registration number 41271, and I represent the people. In this case, the trial court appropriately analyzed the Batson challenge based on existing case law, and there's no reason to believe that the trial court's findings would have been different had he specifically mentioned the word Miller-El. In this case, the trial court, after the defendant had established a prima facie case and the prosecutor had given a race-neutral reason for rebutting that, the burden shifted to the defendant to satisfy that there was, in fact, a discriminatory intent in that case. Here, the defense attorney simply responded that, "Not really. I can't believe that the fact that she's agreeing with what the prosecutor said is race-neutral." There's no challenge, as the court has pointed out, to go on to a comparative juror analysis. However, what we see from the trial court's ruling here is that the trial court was analyzing, saying she was not very forthcoming. She was reluctant. She was hesitant to speak up. This inherently is in comparison to the other jurors. If we look to the jurors Miss L and Miss H, which I cite in my brief, who are also discussing whether police discharge firearms too much, these jurors are able to articulate reasons for why they rank the police at a lower score on the scale of 1 to 10, which the prosecutor asked. One of these jurors says that it's because she's just moved to Denver, so she really has no basis for forming an opinion. Another of these jurors says that she simply has no experience in this matter and can't give a reason. In contrast, our challenge juror here says, "I don't know, it's just something I've heard." They're one-word responses in many of the places. And here we have an unusual record in that it actually shows us both the juror's verbal responses as well as her nonverbal responses. We have the prosecutor indicating that she had to speak up, and that's reflected in the trial court's order as well. We have a juror that the cold record even indicates she is not forthcoming. She is not engaged. And if, in fact, the trial court was looking at this court's published decision in Marion, the trial court was doing exactly what we hope trial courts do, and relying on the published opinions of this court, our Supreme Court, and the U.S. Supreme Court. There's no reason to believe that the trial court somehow negated its responsibility. And requiring the court to go into a recess every time defense counsel raises a Batson challenge, to perhaps have a record prepared, because very few of our courts have real time, have the benefit of seeing that immediately on the screen, and that's rarely the certified official transcript. So we don't know whether, even if there had been the benefit of real time, the court would have been able to rely on that transcript. It's not certified. Perhaps we would have had to go into a recess to wait for a certified transcript. This poses an unreasonable delay on our courts. When the trial court, after listening to the arguments of counsel, comparing the juror's responses to the others, and listening to the juror, the trial court observed her demeanor, was able to observe exactly how she responded to counsel, how her body language demonstrated her responses, and whether she was, in fact, engaged. Here, our record demonstrates that she was not.
Counsel, do you accept your opponent's characterization that the juror's agreement with the prosecution was how she was not engaged, or do you rather look at lack of engagement as one reason and then her agreement with the prosecution as another reason, both of which would be, you know, race neutral?
Yeah, then we look at both of these reasons as race neutral, and it's clear that the trial court did as well in looking at the juror's nonverbal responses, her one-word responses, particularly in comparing it with some of the other jurors. Now, back to the discussion of the police, many of the other jurors who ranked the police at lower scores articulated sometimes fairly lengthy reasons for why they issued these scores. Our juror, in contrast, at most was a single sentence, generally 5 to 6 words. This indicates a much shorter, briefer responses, and the nonverbal responses are actually present in the record. Additionally, simply agreeing with counsel is certainly cause for concern because it may indicate that the juror either is not paying attention to counsel, so she doesn't have a lot of responses, or that she may not be able to effectively engage in deliberations, both of which would be legitimate race-neutral reasons that the defense made no attempt to rebut. Instead, the defense simply responded, "Well, I don't think that's a race-neutral reason." The trial court moved on, defense made no further record, and we moved on to the trial. And further, if we compare this case to Miller L., which the defense relies on as well, in that case, there were 11 African-American jurors on the panel. 10 of them were struck through the use of peremptories. One made it through. The reasons that they were strided, the reasons that the court relies on in Miller L. is the cumulative effect of the prosecutor's strikes of these jurors. 10 of 11. Additionally, if we look to Miller L., we also see that in that case, the prosecutor, when conducting the voir dire, used a gory description of the death penalty only when speaking to the African-American jurors. There, they used a bland and much less descriptive description in discussing the death penalty when speaking to white jurors. This also factored into the court's opinion in Miller L., and those are simply not factors here. For one thing, we don't have the cumulative impact. Now, we're certainly not trying to diminish the importance of conducting a thorough Batson analysis or the importance of a fair cross-section. Clearly, these are critical and fundamental to a defendant's constitutional rights. But here, those rights were satisfied by exactly what the trial court did. We can't expect the trial court to go back to conduct an analysis when the record is clear, when the trial court was able to observe the juror, able to observe her responses, to compare them to the other jurors. We don't need the trial court to specifically go through and say, well, here, juror 2 answered this to this question, but juror 6 answered this. So is this in fact race neutral? When we have the when we have the court able to observe and counsel able to observe and bring any of these things to the court's attention, counsel didn't do it. And the court also was able, after observing the juror's demeanor, focused on the lack of engagement, the fact that she was not forthcoming. And we see that these are, in fact, supported by our record here. The trial court did what is required. Defense counsel did not meet its burden of demonstrating purposeful discrimination, and the record simply doesn't demonstrate that that was the case here. We have a case of a juror who was not paying attention, who was not responding, and who had nonverbal answers that counsel could not hear. That is a race-neutral reason, as is simply agreeing, and there's no rebuttal. Accordingly, the trial court followed the Batson analysis. The trial court did precisely what it is required to do. And if this court has no further questions...
I do have a question. I'm still trying to get a handle on what is the difference that Miller L requires as opposed to Batson Apparently it states that if a prosecutor's proffered reason for striking a black panelist applies just as well to an otherwise similar non-black who is permitted to serve, that is evidence tending to prove purposeful discrimination to be considered at Batson's third step. So you are to consider this evidence, but does it change anything in the Batson analysis? Is it still a factual question for the court? And if it is, do you have a standard of if there's evidence to support the court's finding? What are we supposed to do with all that?
Your Honor, it's still under the, it still factors into factor three of the Batson analysis, and it's still a factual determination. Now, if we had a situation where the defense had raised an issue and pointed out that there was in fact a juror who'd made similar responses, who they'd also had to ask to speak up, perhaps then we would be addressing a situation where we would be required to go into an in-camera comparative juror analysis with counsel with a transcript, something along those lines. But here, we're substantially distinguishable from Miller L. And the mandate that defense counsel speaks of doesn't actually change the standard of review that we look at here. We're still under abuse of discretion standard when we get to the third fact. This is still a factual finding. Now, if there was nothing in the record to support the court's rulings, perhaps we'd have a different situation. But here, we have a very thorough record that demonstrates that this juror was non-responsive, that supports both the prosecutor's reading, the prosecutor's argument, and the trial court's findings. We have a record here that enables the court to conduct an abuse of discretion review. Now, if we had a record that didn't demonstrate this, if we had a record where the juror had never spoken, perhaps, to counsel and had never been addressed in voir dire, then we may be in a completely different situation. But that's simply not the situation we're presented with here. The trial court followed the Batson factors, and the trial court's ruling is subject to an abuse of discretion review. Here, the record demonstrates that the trial court's ruling was supported by the record, and that the trial court did not abuse its discretion. The people therefore respectfully request that this court affirm the defendant's convictions.
Can you rebuttal?
A trial court necessarily abuses its discretion when it applies the wrong legal standard. My argument here is that in step three, the trial court did not engage fully in the correct legal standard without engaging in the comparative juror analysis. To answer your question, Judge Miller, earlier, Georgia Akey was the court reporter on December 1st, the first day of trial. When trial courts want a portion of the record read back or transcribed, this can occur in real time. Transcripts of testimony are prepared for deliberating juries all the time. It's not a significant burden.
But no one requested that that occur, correct?
No, not explicitly, no. I would like to go back and look at what we know from the record on appeal. We know that the prosecutor was attempting to ferret out anti-police sentiment in this case, and especially whether they discharged their weapons too much. We know that because the police in this case stood up and shot the defendant several times and other people were injured. Ms. Jackson's responses on that question did not distinguish her from other non-black members who were not struck. And when you do compare her responses that are now characterized as not engaging or not forthcoming, it becomes clear that those are not distinguishable from other responses by other non-black panelists. And that in reality, Ms. Jackson was a much more prosecution-friendly panelist than many of the white jurors that remained on the jury. Let's look at Ms. Likens, just for example. When Ms. Jackson gave the police a rating of 8, 1 to 10, 10 being the best, Ms. Likens rated the police a 5. on a scale of 1 to 10. She opined that the police were not all good and not all bad, but that some of them had a problem with authority. And when she was asked whether she could be fair toward the police, she expressed uncertainty about whether she could do so, but the prosecutor did not strike her.
The defendant point these comparisons out to the trial court?
Like I said, the defense counsel simply said compared to other jurors, and may very well have had these examples in his head at the time, but there was not a specific panelist by panelist comparison. But that's what the court could have done. No one here had the transcript. The court could have recessed to get the transcript, and then they could have done that. It could have happened.
Isn't there some obligation on defense counsel to do something about it and say, hey, she's no different from anybody else. Why are you striking her?
Actually, that was said. That much was said.
But he
didn't. Compared to other juries on the panel, here, I'll get the quote.
Right, but he didn't point out any specifics.
Well, he didn't say, we didn't have the transcript, Your Honor, and that's why it's incumbent upon the trial court to recess to get the transcript, because what he did say was, based on, when compared to other panelists on this jury, that Ms. Jackson's responses were not different. They did not stick out in any way as not engaged or not forthcoming, and the fact that she was agreeing with the prosecution is no reason at all, much less a face-neutral reason.
Wouldn't that argument then show that the issue was before the court and the court considered it in making its ruling?
Could you repeat that? I'm sorry, I didn't catch the first part.
I say your argument seems to say that the issue was before the court, the comparison question, that the court did consider it and therefore satisfied Miller L.
Well, I think that the court didn't understand, even though our defense counsel used the word compared to other jurors or panelists on this jury, I don't think that registered the obligation of Miller L. to perform the comparative jury analysis specifically. But if that needs to happen, which I'm saying it does, in order for any factual findings to be given deference on appeal, then let's remand and let the court go back and do the comparative jury analysis, because it's all right here. It's done. It's done now. We can remand and have him do it and see if he reaches the same conclusion that he did before. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Thank you both for your fine arguments. The case is deemed submitted, and you may expect a written opinion in due course.